From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in New Orleans in 1994. The city had been racked by corruption in the police department. Democrat Marc Morial was elected mayor with 54% of the vote. Morial had promised to, quote, clean out City Hall with a shovel, not a broom. Morial's public approval rating during his 8 years in office stayed near 70%. Tourism increased during his tenure. New Orleans' downtown saw the addition of 14 new hotels. And here was one of the keys. New Orleans' violent crime rate fell 60% over Marc Morial's 2 terms. He was term limited out of office, and he left to become the president of the National Urban League of America. He has remained in that role, and you probably remember the mayor who followed Marc Morial, Democrat Ray Nagin, who is currently serving a sentence in federal prison related to fraud after Hurricane Katrina. Morial is visiting Rochester this week as a guest of the Urban League of Rochester and will be back in town at the end of March. Let me welcome to the program the president and CEO of the National Urban League, Marc Morial. It's great to have you, Mark. How are you?
I'm glad to be here. Thank you very much.
And Bill Clark is here, who is the president and CEO of the Urban League of Rochester. And Bill, nice to have you as well.
Thanks. It's good to be back.
Well, Mark, for you, you're coming to Rochester in 1 month on March 29th. You're going to be there for the Urban League of Rochester's annual luncheon. I know you travel the country and meet with leaders in various cities. You've also been meeting with possible next presidents as
yes.
part of a series of events. How's that going?
Very interestingly, and I'm just very proud to be here and very proud to be with Bill Clark and the Urban League of Rochester. And I think people in this community, we certainly want them to know that the Urban League of Rochester is one of the very best Urban League affiliates in the country and have been so for a long time. Under Bill Clark's leadership, under Bill Johnson's leadership, there's just had an uninterrupted string of progress and impact in this community. So I look forward to being back in Rochester on the 29th of March, which is a Tuesday at noon at the Convention Center for their annual luncheon. And so far as the presidential candidates are concerned, I joined with 8 other leaders of historic civil rights organizations in extending an invitation to every candidate of both parties to participate in what we call a civil rights briefing. The idea is that we need to elevate many of the issues and challenges that we face as urban communities, as people of color, as people who are very concerned about the future of the American economy, social justice issues. We felt like we need to have an open conversation. So 2 candidates thus far have both responded and met with us. Those were, of course, Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. And it was really a conversation where we presented to them what we call the 21st Century Agenda for Jobs and Freedom, which covers 5 areas: economics, education, criminal justice, voting rights, and health. And that agenda includes a whole set of policy recommendations, as well as statistical diagnostics of the challenges we face. So they were very good conversations. Both Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders exhibited a great deal of interest and knowledge and passion for our issues. Hillary Clinton, I think, was conversant with a lot of specificity on a wide range of issues, owing, I think, to her long experience. I think Bernie Sanders' message is about passion and a sense of the direction of the country and the influence of big money. Now, we still await responses from the remaining candidates, all of whom happen to be Republicans, because as a nonpartisan organization, we believe that all candidates need to recognize the central importance of economic and social justice issues to the future of the country, whether it's immigration or income inequality, the achievement gap when it comes to schools. These issues are central to what we want to be as a 21st century nation.
How come they haven't responded?
I couldn't tell you. And a lot of times in primaries, candidates are overtly politically obsessed with their bases. And that may be the case, but here's a compare and contrast. Last summer, when we extended an invitation to all of the Democratic and Republican candidates to join us at our annual conference in Fort Lauderdale, and we afforded every candidate a 30-minute block of time to make a presentation. Both Dr. Carson, along with Governor Bush, showed up, came, and spent quality time with us. So it's. I'm not pleased that these candidates have not yet responded, but on our end, we will continue to reach out. Because while the political conversation in America may be partisan and it may be charged, we believe that the issues that we stand for and we work for every day are more important than partisan politics.
Well, we wanted to get a chance to hear what the presidential contenders have been saying about race in this election cycle. So let's start with one of the Democrats, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Here she is speaking at the Columbia School of Public Policy on the subject of race and justice.
We have to come to terms with some hard truths about race and justice in America. There is something profoundly wrong when African American men are still far more likely to be stopped and searched by police, charged with crimes, and sentenced to longer prison terms than are meted out to their white counterparts. There is something wrong when a third of all black men face the prospect of prison during their lifetimes. And an estimated 1.5 million black men are, quote, missing from their families and communities because of incarceration and premature death. There is something wrong when more than one out of every three young black men in Baltimore cannot find a job. There is something wrong when trust between law enforcement and the communities they serve breaks down as far as it has in many of our communities. We have allowed our criminal justice system to get out of balance. And these recent tragedies should galvanize us to come together as a nation to find our balance again. We should begin by heeding the pleas of Freddie Gray's family for peace and unity, echoing the families of Michael Brown, Trayvon Martin, and others in the past years.
That's Secretary Hillary Clinton. Here's Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. He was speaking about racism during a campaign event in Phoenix, Arizona.
If we were sitting here, or in your case, standing here, 30 years ago, and somebody said, you know, I have a crazy idea. I think that maybe in 2008, the United States will have overcome its racist history and elect an African American to be president. People would have said, that's crazy. That won't happen. It happened because we overcame a lot of racism. But let us be very clear. While we have overcome a lot of racism, we have come a long way, we still have a long way to go. It is not acceptable to me, and I know to you, that an African American baby, a male baby born today, if we do not change things, stands a 1 in 4 chance of being in prison during his life. It is not acceptable to me that we have seen young black men walk down streets in this country, be beaten and be killed unjustly. That is not acceptable. Most police officers, I was a mayor for 8 years, and I worked with the police department. It's a tough job. Most cops do it well. But when a police officer breaks the law, that officer must be held accountable.
Now, the Republican frontrunner is Donald Trump. He has not given any specific speeches or addresses or lectures on the subject of race or social justice or any related issues. But he has defended himself and his record in various ways when the subject of race has come up. and it came up during a campaign event in Laredo, Texas, before the Nevada caucuses. Here's Trump talking about his history of employing Latinos, and then his response to a challenge from a member of the news media.
Such a great relationship with the Hispanics, and very interestingly, in Nevada, for those that haven't heard, they just did a poll, and I'm leading, not only am I leading by a lot in the poll, but almost more important to me, because I employ hundreds, and actually I employ thousands of Hispanics, and over the years, tens of thousands, but I'm leading in the poll by a landslide with the Hispanics, which is a great honor for me. So thank you. Yeah, go ahead.
You know, 53,000 Hispanics turn 18 years of age in the country every month. Born in the United States of voting age, 54 million plus Hispanics.
Right.
Many feel that what you said, when you said that the people across the border are rapists and murderers.
No, no, no. We're talking about illegal immigration, and everybody understands it. And you know what? That's a typical case. Wait. That's a typical case of the press with misinterpretation. They take a half a sentence. By the way, they take a half a sentence, then they take a quarter of a sentence, they put it all together. It's a typical thing. And you're with Telemundo, and Telemundo should be ashamed.
Are you concerned at all about the possibility of a Trump presidency?
I'm concerned about any candidacy, quite candidly, that promotes division.
Is this candidacy promoting division?
And I think what you've heard from him promotes division. When you talk about building walls, when you talk about the condemnation and banning of immigrants based on religion or race or country of origin, when you begin to elevate those as though they're legitimate public policies, that indeed is division. But I think whether it's Mr. Trump or Mr. Cruz or Mr. Rubio or Governor Kasich or Dr. Carson, they should sit down with us to hear our ideas and to understand our perspective on these issues. So I hope that at some point in time they're going to respond and say yes.
Okay. We're talking to Mark Muriel, who is coming to Rochester on March 29th as a guest of the annual Urban League of Rochester's annual luncheon there. It's March 29th, noon at the Rochester Riverside Convention Center. Bill Clark, tickets available, urbanleagueofrochester.org, yes?
Yes. Individual tickets are $60, our table for $600, and www.ulr.org, and sign on, and we will get you signed up.
What are you most eager to hear about from Mark on the 29th of March?
Well, one of the things that we really want to hear about is where we stand in the presidential election. And we know that as we get closer and closer, the candidates will be more, we'll know who's running.
We're getting more clarity after Super Tuesday.
Yeah. Right.
And look, I'll say this. I think that what's very interesting to me is how this primary process on both sides creates outsized influence for a handful of states. You know, in essence, you've had four key primaries or caucuses: Nevada, Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina. And those four caucuses, two caucuses and two primaries, have already winnowed the field. But and are those four states super representative of a broad cross-section of America? Not necessarily so.
No, I think we've talked about that on this program many times. Iowa and New Hampshire, two of the least diverse states, outsized power, small states, and they have winnowed the field, as Mark said, even though a tiny number of delegates have been awarded on both sides. So it's an interesting process. It's a whole other hour of the host venting and all of our frustration. Though you never know, with April 19th, at least on the Republican side, New York could play a crucial role at that point. I've done predicting. I've learned in the last 6 months, stop assuming I know anything about where these races are going. But I also want to ask you, you know, when you think about the next president, I go back to 8 years ago, 2 weeks from now, it's going to mark the eight-year anniversary of then-Senator Obama's speech on race in Philadelphia. And I think most of our audience probably recalls not only the moments that led up to that. You know, there were his political opponents were trying to to injure the Obama campaign with Reverend Wright, et cetera. And President, then Senator Obama stood up and gave a speech on race that a lot of people say is might be the best speech he's ever given. So we're going to go back on this program in a couple of weeks. We're going to revisit what he said, and we're going to take a look at where the progress has been made and where it has not been made. But I want to ask you if you feel, well, I don't want to load the question one way or another. How do you feel about where race in this country is after almost 8 years of President Obama?
So I think that President Obama's election held with it a great deal of promise. I believe that I wasn't completely surprised, but many are surprised at the level of invective and backlash that his success as a candidate and ultimately his inauguration as president engendered. The rise of the Tea Party, basically a political approach by his opponents, which said we are going to basically draw a line in the sand. The most offensive things that occurred in his first term were the elements to discredit him based on where he was born. The name calling, trying to paint him as a quote unquote socialist. I thought those were veiled proxies for race because they were an effort to delegitimize his candidacy. Now, here's what's true. If you look at just some facts, the fact of the matter is that for all Americans, the unemployment rate today is lower than it was in January of 2009.
Significantly lower.
The unemployment rate for blacks and Hispanics is lower today than it was in 2009. 20 million more Americans, so a shade less than that, now have health coverage, including large numbers of people of color. And if a handful of governors in the South would embrace the expansion of Medicaid, that number would be much, much higher. And we would be farther along on the road of closing health disparities in this country. So if you look at the facts of the matter, I think the president has certainly made a tremendous difference. I think he has had an opportunity to shape and reshape with diversity the judiciary, the district courts, and the appellate courts in the country. And I also believe that one's true impact can only be understood maybe 10 years after they left office, because a lot depends on whether the changes they brought on have been institutionalized. But the president, to me, has been remarkable in his grace and coolness under a tremendous deal of pressure, whether it's the pressure of the problems of the country, the Great Recession, the challenges in foreign affairs with the instability in the Middle East, or simply the way in which his opponents have sought to vilify him. I think he's held his head high, and he's demonstrated that a president who is African-American can competently manage and lead this nation and be a leader for all Americans.
Now, I think it's hard to argue with Mark's pointing out that Republicans have tried to sort of marginalized or delegitimized. Mitch McConnell said, I think weeks after the president took office in 2009, our goal is to make him a one-term president. Oppose, oppose, oppose. But I also suspect some conservative listeners and many Republicans would say, look, politics, black, white, Latino, Asian, male, female, or otherwise, has become polarized. And that if Hillary Clinton is president, if Bernie Sanders is president, that you will probably see some sharp division as well, maybe some similar tactics. And that if Bernie Sanders were president right now, if Martin O'Malley were president right now, if Hillary Clinton were president right now, you'd probably see the same reaction regarding Justice Scalia's passing, for example, in the next Supreme Court justiceship. So some might say, well, Mark, I understand the opposition is strong and sharp and maybe wasn't always that way. That could be debated. But why is it about race?
Well, you know, here's the thing. It's very difficult sometimes to slice race out. Usually race is part of a more complex potion, if you will, of reasons and rationales. It doesn't sometimes sit alone as in a transparent way. And I think race has been a factor. I'm not going to suggest that just old-fashioned hardball politics has also not been a factor. But what struck me was that the president really did not get much of a honeymoon. So if you think about his first major proposal, which was an economic stimulus plan to help the country recover, there were people who put a line in the sand and said, we will not vote for it. The opposition surfaced before the proposal ever surfaced. That, to me, was a sign that this was going to be hardball politics. So we are in a hardball politics, and to some extent, I think it's not may not be hardball politics, but really hardball politics on top of a very interesting and important debate about the future of this country. I mean, there's a little bit of a battle between the future and the past. You know, do you look at the past and say, boy, let's make it like it was in 1950 or 1970 or 1980? Or do we say, you know, we have to embrace and build an America for the 2020s, for the 2030s? It's more diverse. It's more multicultural. It operates in a global economic marketplace. It operates with technology and transparency. It operates with young people and millennials having different sensibilities about race and gender identity than previous. So you really have to embrace that. To say we have to embrace the future isn't a condemnation of the past, but we shouldn't be nostalgic and say, boy, let's just turn the clock back to the Reagan years, or let's turn them back to the Johnson years, or let's turn them back to the Nixon years, or what about the Eisenhower years? Mm-hmm. If it was just like that, everything was great, everything was fine. No, everything wasn't great, everything wasn't fine. There were a deep set of challenges that people worked to overcome. The issue really is politics and political debate and division can be sharp. But what leaders also have to do is find common ground on important issues beyond ideology, beyond party, beyond region of the country. And I think that's what's been difficult in this country in the last few years.
He hasn't been given a chance on that, huh?
No, and you've got to meet him. It takes two to tango. Compromise doesn't mean you embrace my philosophy or I embrace your philosophy. Compromise, so things like budget issues, there can be compromise. There are some issues which may be much more philosophical, much more, if I would suggest, ideological and heartfelt. But the inability to get budgets, the inability to solve fiscal problems, sometimes is just political stubbornness.
I think when we talk about the good old days, 50s, 60s, 70s, they were good old days for some people. In a segregated America, if you lived in a comfortable suburb and you were doing well, that's what you remember. And you are not. And I think maybe what Mark is saying is the president has sought a future where everyone feels that same sense of opportunity, and it's an interesting observation. Let me ask Bill and Mark then one more point on this. I'm going to see if they can endorse my optimism, right? Because I've heard from some people, typically progressives, but not always, who are, I think we're coming to the end of the Obama 8 years, and they are feeling somewhat dismayed about the racial invective that we still see in the country. And there is some, you know, sort of head hanging going, wow, you know, this isn't as much progress as we wanted to see. Mm-hmm. So my optimism says maybe it took a first black president not to heal everything's great, put a bow on it, you know, right. Post-racial, which is the silliest word ever, but maybe it took the first black president to bring more of what roiled underneath back to the surface so we could get a look at it and we could deal with it more directly before we start making gains. Bill, that's an optimistic view, but what do you think, Bill?
Well, I agree with you that when you look at the Obama years and you look at the resistance that he faced, that it really did bring a lot of the issues to the surface. And one of the things that we're seeing now as a result of that is when you look at the Republican presidential race and you look at the topics that are being discussed, the hate, the personal attacks. I mean, is this how we run a presidential campaign? So the issues have been brought to the front, and we're hoping that being at the front, that we can begin to address them more effectively. I mean, last night when the Oscars were on, and when Chris Rock talked about the fact that there were no black nominees, you know, if you don't have the discussion, then you don't make progress. So I do agree that the discussions need to be had, and so we can move forward.
That's amazing how many of my white friends were saying, "Boy, he's going on for a while here. I'm kind of getting uncomfortable." I said, "Good, we should be uncomfortable."
Well,
that.
You know, and
it should make everybody uncomfortable.
It never suits dealing with a country's racial challenges to suppress the conversation. The issue really is to have the conversation with both candor, clarity, and civility. And that's what we struggle with, having it with candor, where we understand the facts, with civility, where we can talk to each other in a respectful way. It is not easy to do that, but it's the conversation that the nation needs to continue to have to recognize that as far as we've come, and we should be proud as far as we've come as a nation, nothing should take away from the dramatic transformation we've had, but undoing long histories of exclusion take time, they take energy, and they take effort. But I think it's important because it's also the notion of America demonstrating to the world that you can have a multi-ethnic democracy. You can have a multi-ethnic democracy that provides economic opportunity for all. And America should stand. We stand and should stand for economic opportunity and a multicultural democracy, because that's what the 21st century has to be about.
I've got a few more minutes, and I want to hit one more subject with Mark Morial before he's gone. He's the president and CEO of the National Urban League since 2003, right, Mark?
Yes.
Since 2003. And if I were to say former mayor of New Orleans, a lot of Americans think Ray Nagin because they remember Katrina. And I understand that, and I'm certainly not an expert on the mayoral procession in New Orleans, but a lot of people remember Mr. Nagin. Before Mr. Nagin, Mark was there. And everything I've read indicates that the 1990s, I think you were there with 94 to 2002,
yeah.
In the 1990s there was a real renaissance, and there were a real surge in New Orleans in economic activity, in opportunity. And so and I'm not just saying this because Mark's sitting here. You know, if I had more time to dig into your record, sir, I'd be hitting you harder. But let me just. But I only have a couple of minutes, so let me just ask you briefly. You know, you come into Rochester. We're a heavily segregated city. We mm-hmm. have extreme poverty, higher than most cities of its size in the country. We have more than 50% of the kids in this city growing up in poverty. I wonder what you've learned in New Orleans. That I mean, every city's different. Every situation's a little different. But what have you learned through your work in New Orleans? And when you travel the country to cities like Rochester, that can be applied.
So you know, in New Orleans, part of our formula was over-investing in youth. Over-investing in youth. And that meant, from the city's perspective, we didn't have control of the schools. We dramatically expand the entire, if you will, tableau or panoply of after-school programs. Summer programs, summer jobs, free camps, swimming pools. We over-invested. We put capital money into rec centers, into pools. We put operating dollars and federal dollars into jobs and after-school programs. That was really important. Secondly, we focused on asset building, mainly by promoting home ownership, using soft seconds, using low-interest loans, relationships with banks and Fannie and Freddie, housing counseling, a comprehensive effort to give people a chance to buy houses and own a piece of the community.
Could they afford them long term?
We had to make them affordable through the use of soft seconds. We had to put some subsidies. But I said, look, should we subsidize affordable rental? Yes. But should we subsidize affordable rental and then find it problematic to subsidize, if you will, affordable home ownership? The government spends a tremendous amount of money in tax credits, direct subsidies, Section 8 certificates, subsidizing rental development in every city in America. Good, you need a rental marketplace. But we need to help through soft seconds, through down payment assistance programs, people to buy houses. The third thing we did was we made it a priority to try to build opportunities for African-American-owned businesses. In all the contracting that we did, in every public-private partnership that we had a hand in, we promoted it under the banner of open access and inclusion. Those are a handful of things. Thirdly, the leadership of the community, business, civic, political, religious, black, white, Hispanic, has to work together as much as they can. What does that mean? Sit around the table, debate, and argue. Try to find common ground. You can't manage an American city today. The city can be segregated and divided, but the leadership has to find common ground around a common table. And if you do that, you'll have some victories. You won't always agree. So I learned in New Orleans, and look, New Orleans is interesting. I had a great run as mayor. When Ray Nagin got elected, the public experimented with someone with zero political experience. It was a disaster. He was the worst mayor in New Orleans history. He's now serving a 10-year term in the federal penitentiary. And the problem is that we had the worst mayor at the most difficult inning in American urban history, and that was New Orleans history. That was Katrina. So when we needed a strong leader, a good quarterback, we had an amateur running the show. And we paid for it as a community, and the comeback has been much more difficult because of the years of Nagin, and have been better since he's departed and Mayor Landrieu's been in office. It hadn't been perfect, but it's been far better, more competent, more directed. And I think it also shows, look, this is true. New Orleans had black mayors, white mayors. We had great black mayors. We've had great white mayors. We've had lousy white mayors, and we've had a lousy black mayor. So, you know, just the issue of the race of the mayor in and of itself is not going to be determinative of competence, the agenda, compassion, or progress for the city.
Well, I wish we had more time, but you can see Mark Morial, the president and CEO of the National Urban League, March 29th at noon at the Rochester Riverside Convention Center. Tickets right now at urbanleagueofrochester.org. Bill Clark, I know you've worked hard to bring him here both this week and the end of March, so thank you for being here, and I know we'll have many more conversations.
And I look forward to coming back, just want the community to know that the Urban League of Rochester does a fantastic job here, and we're proud of Bill and his team.